the Kingston Police Service Board received a presentation on a new community drug checking program that has already shown promise in improving public health and safety in the region. The initiative is part of Ontario's drug checking community, a leader in the delivery of these services and community-led monitoring of the unregulated drug supply. The program was launched by Toronto's drug checking service in 2019. The program offers drug users the ability to have their unregulated drugs tested before consumption to ensure they're not contaminated or in unexpected concentration. It also provides a snapshot of the unregulated drug supply market in Kingston, data that is made available to all those impacted and the general public through emergency alerts and monthly reports. Kingston became the first jurisdiction outside of Toronto to join the initiative in November 2024. With the long-term goal of establishing at least one drug checking site in each of Ontario's 29 public health unit regions. Locally, the program operates through the Integrated Care Hub on Montreal Street. Karen McDonald, Executive Director of Toronto's Drug Checking Service and Ontario's Drug Checking Community, presented an in-depth overview of the program's structure, impact, and findings.
So our program is made up of three groups. There are collection sites, analysis sites, and then the central operating team. So collection sites are community agencies that are exempted to collect samples from and share results with service users. Their main role, like the Integrated Care Hub, is just to, you know, have existing and trusted relationships with people who use drugs, collect samples, share results, and really educate their communities about what it is that's circulating. Next, we have analysis sites. So these are the purple. We currently have three. These are clinical research or government labs that are exempted to analyze samples and report drug checking results. And we're super fortunate. These are, you know, scientific experts who are incredibly skilled at determining the composition of really any specimen, and we're using drugs. And then we have the central operating team. So that's the team that I run at St. Michael's Hospital. Super small team. Our job is really just to make the lives of the collection sites and the analysis sites easier.
Justine McIsaac, Coordinator of Consumption and Treatment Services at Kingston's ICH, offered context on the implementation of the program in Kingston.
Just to give you some context as to why we decided to start drug checking in our community is because we have a bunch of people that are very unwell and are using substances that are very dangerous to not only the people that use them, but the greater community. And our goal with this program was to give people a better knowledge of what it was they were using, as well as the community. Initially, I piloted a project with a local group through Queens, which was called Spectra Plasmatics. I helped them write a grant to Health Canada to pilot their equipment with the support of the municipality as well. In turn, that allowed me to get the equipment for free, which is a $30,000 piece of equipment. And I have worked on that relationship with them since. The machine itself takes a very small amount of the substance or a piece of equipment that person has used to inject the substance, and we will test that, and it'll tell us exactly what is in the substance that the person used.
McIsaac, drawing from firsthand experience at the ICH, emphasized that the program had an immediate life-saving impact.
Somebody presented a substance to me that looked like MDMA, which is considered a party drug. It's very casually used amongst young people in college, universities, things like that. This drug presented as if it was what it was, and it was not. It looked like MDMA. It was stamped as if it was MDMA, and it turned out to be pill-pressed fentanyl. Now, the risks for that individual who has no opioid dependency whatsoever, that would have been consequential and most likely would have resulted in death for that individual if they had not come in and tested that drugs. Because he brought that sample in and I was able to test it, I was able then to work with public health and formulate a community alert to warn people that there were substances in our community that looked like something else, but actually weren't what they were presenting to be.
In her presentation, McDonald shared what they've uncovered about the unregulated drug supply. The primary focus was on fentanyl and other opioids. While a common fear is party drugs being laced with fentanyl, the more common case is fentanyl being contaminated with other substances or having unpredictable concentration.
We have checked over 8,000 samples that were not expected to be opioids, and we've actually only confirmed fentanyl or another high-potency opioid in 11 of those. So certainly not to say that it doesn't happen. The risks are incredibly high, but I do think there's just this general conception that this happens all the time. And what kind of worries me about that messaging is just that we're detracting from the population of people who are actually at risk. If we're putting all of our focus on, you know, people who use cocaine and MDMA and their risk of being contaminated by fentanyl, we're kind of ignoring the population of people who actually are at risk and dying.
In Toronto, only 3% of fentanyl samples tested were found to contain what users believed they were consuming. Although fewer samples have been collected in Kingston to date, the trend is similar.
And on the Kingston front, not a single fentanyl sample that has been collected by the Integrated Care Hub since we launched this service has met service users' expectations. So every single sample has been contaminated with unexpected drugs.
Fentanyl samples are often contaminated with other high-potency opioids, as well as central nervous system and respiratory depressants like benzodiazepines and animal tranquilizers. McIsaac noted that this contamination significantly impacts operations at the ICH, especially complicating overdose responses.
When we first opened, an opioid overdose response was pretty cut and dry. Now it has become so complicated that we've had to change our whole process of how we respond to overdoses to ensure that we're keeping people as safe as possible. So we're constantly on a learning curve as to how we can treat people appropriately and keep them as safe as possible.
In addition to contamination, the strength of fentanyl in the unregulated supply is highly unpredictable, with concentrations fluctuating drastically.
For one thing, what does that mean for the person who's using the drug? Are they experiencing withdrawal? But also think about if you were to flip it the other way. Someone's tolerance is kind of down because the fentanyl supply is quote unquote weaker. And then suddenly the next month it increases by 5 times the amount. Of course, the risk of overdose is going to be higher.
Members of the Kingston Police Service Board recently visited the collection site at the ICH. Board member Adam Coven remarked on the strong trust that has developed between service providers and people seeking services, a key factor in the program's effectiveness.
Going to the site yesterday was amazing for so many reasons, but one of the things that I applaud is that here in Kingston, which is the only center that we know of, the amount of trust that obviously has gone on because of your services, your staff, your support. Without breaching that trust to the people that are coming to you, which amazes me. I'm standing there with the chief and deputy police, and we have people that you're saying are coming in with their drugs and their testing. It's an amazing amount of trust.
Board Chair Jared Stearns asked the first question in the Q&A portion of the presentation.
If fentanyl is like so dirty or unpredictable, why is it the drug of choice for so many people?
Unfortunately, the population that I work with has opioid dependency, so they're physically dependent on it. Primarily, the population before bootleg fentanyl was introduced to the market, primarily people were using OxyContin. It was overprescribed, but we didn't see near the amount of deaths associated because it was prescription grade. People developed a tolerance to it. They knew how to dose themselves appropriately. This is kind of what's available in the illicit market. And really, it's, in my opinion, people just taking advantage of very vulnerable, sick people in the long run. But yeah, it's not necessarily about choice. It's about there's no other option for people in the illicit market. Obviously, from a treatment perspective, as a support worker, I'm always looking for ways and means to reduce people's risk of either their use or overdose, whether it be through methadone, Suboxone, Sublocade, things like that. But it's unfortunately, it's not a choice at this point. It's what's on the market.
And are you seeing overdoses daily?
Yes.
When asked how this information can be used to find and remove the toxic drug supply, McDonald and McIsaac both stated that this would require larger solutions, but the program can still be a level of intervention.
From my perspective, the supply is always going to be toxic if it's unregulated. I'm not sure, like, at this time, what our service and police can do to really, like, clean up the supply. Interestingly, what we have seen is that one of the primary things that people, service users, do with their results is go back to the person they bought their drugs from and put kind of what we call grassroots pressure on the supply. So going back to someone and saying, I bought this, but I'm actually getting this. I don't want this thing. I'm either not going to use it, I'm going to go find it from someone else, or at least just, like, providing that feedback. So, like, that's there as well.
And just sharing the knowledge with each other too. Like I said, you know, ensuring that our constables that are out on road dealing with people every day, they have an understanding of what's going on in community and behaviors associated to drug use, and are well equipped to try and support and deal with some of that.
Finally, when asked what message they most wanted Kingston Police to take away, McDonald and McIsaac offered the following.
Watching how complex people's mental health and substance use needs have become, I've also watched in the years that I've been doing this work, the expectations of police on road grow to an unrealistic expectation. I've watched police become police to crisis workers, to triage workers, to finding people shelter, to dealing with complex mental health and substance use needs, to responding to overdoses. This is really, I feel like, has really impacted policing. And so first off, I'd like to thank you guys for everything that you do. But I think the takeaway is that for me in working with this complex population is that, and please forgive me, but the intent is to get high, not to die. People are seeking momentary relief from, like, excruciating physical, mental, and emotional pain. And it's really the bigger picture as to what happened to these people along the way. It's not necessarily what's wrong with you. It's what happened to you and how much we need to invest in caring for a very vulnerable, complex population, and looking for ways and means to help them not only deal with the traumas that they carry, but feel supported and accepted and develop new coping techniques for themselves. Unfortunately, drugs have a functional purpose for some people, and generally they start using drugs because they served a purpose for them. But as I've watched people go through this very complex, hard lifestyle, I've seen it create more chaos, more trauma, more hurt for these individuals. And it really doesn't get them any further. So I think the takeaway should be is, A, we need to be a lot kinder to our police that are doing the best they can in a community or communities with little resources to help this crisis. But that people are not enjoying this. They're not out living a free for all. This is not them not wanting to be better or not wanting to work or not wanting to have housing. It's their needs are just so complex, and they're just really sick, hurting people. And we need to remember that day in and day out, that these are still members of our community that need love and acceptance.
I guess key takeaways from me would be, first, that we need to accept in rare cases, fentanyl is not what is contaminating other things. In fact, it is fentanyl that is contaminated, and that is really what is driving this crisis. And, you know, we really do need timely and accessible information about what is circulating in the drug supply and public information, you know, regardless of whether you're focused on community safety, harm reduction, treatment, prevention, understanding what it is that's in the drug supply is crucial. So I think just, like, you know, the more information that we can try to generate and make publicly available, and then just really work together to respond. There is no, you know, there is no single response to this crisis, clearly, and it is persisting. So I think, yeah, just as much collaboration as possible, kind of, you know, and just recognizing that everybody's doing their best, but also recognizing the incredibly important role that, like, each different stakeholder plays.
This has been Christina Laurie with CFRC News, supported by the Local Journalism Initiative.
This is Jesse Bell with a local sports report for the Kingston region. The OSFL regular season came to a close on Sunday, so let's do a quick recap of the three seasons for the Kingston Grenadiers. The U14 Grenadiers had a great learning season, but that doesn't necessarily translate to a lot of regular season success. They dropped their opening contest on May 10th, 36-0, before getting a huge win in their follow-up against the Oshawa Hawkeyes, 42-0. They dropped close games to the Ottawa Myers Riders and the Peel Panthers, before closing out their season with back-to-back losses against the North Halton Crimson Tide and the Durham Dolphins. Though not a great statistical season for the Grenadiers, the U14 squad is a new one in the grand scheme of things and certainly learned a great deal about the level of competition seen in OSFL football. The U16 Grenadiers are a great deal more established, with the modern iteration of this U16 squad dating back to the 2009 season, so over the course of 16 years, they've got a lot more experience under their belt, and that showed in the 2025 season. They had a season-opening loss, 22-0, to the Cumberland Panthers, before rolling off multiple wins in a row, five straight, in fact, with victories over Oshawa, Ottawa Myers Riders, the Peel Panthers, the Brampton Bulldogs, before dropping a game to the Durham Dolphins. But they did close out their season with a victory over the Vaughan Rebels, and now await their playoff matchup. No matter how the U16 season ends, it was a great one for the team. A lot of regular season success as they look forward to a playoff date and the potential to make a long run in the OSFL playoffs. We save the best for last as the U18 Grenadiers have had a season to remember, running the table, a perfect regular season with major victories over the Cumberland Panthers, the Brampton Bulldogs, and the Durham Dolphins. They will be the number one seed heading into the OSFL playoffs, and they look primed for a big run to perhaps the first championship in team history. And that is your local sports recap, putting a spotlight on the OSFL and the Kingston Grenadiers. This is Jesse Bell signing off from the CFRC Sports Desk. This is Jesse Bell with the Environment Canada Weather Report for the Kingston region. Monday, June 30th, daytime high of 26 degrees with a real feel in the humidity of 29, mix of sun and cloud throughout the day, dropping down to 20 overnight. Tuesday, July 1st, Canada Day, we have a risk for a thundershower in the morning, about 40%, but that'll give way to mostly sunny conditions and a daytime high of 25 in the afternoon. Wednesday, July 2nd, a bit more rain in the forecast, daytime high of 23, feeling closer to 25. So a little cooler than days past, and a 60% chance of precipitation. Thursday, July 3rd, daytime high of 23 degrees, feeling closer to 25, with a 63% chance of rain throughout the day, dropping down to 13 overnight. Friday, July 4th, daytime high of 22, and it's going to feel like 23, so a lovely day here in the city of Kingston, mostly sunny conditions with a few clouds sprinkled throughout. Moving into the weekend, Saturday, July 5th, daytime high of 24 with mostly sunny conditions. High UV index, though, projected to be 10, so get that sunscreen on, folks. Sunday, July 6th, the sun gives way to rain, 55% chance of precipitation in the region, daytime high of 24, will be quite humid, feeling closer to 28, and then the start of next week, Monday, July 7th, we're going to see a daytime high of 24 with a 55% chance of precipitation. Here is your City of Kingston traffic report for the week. The LaSalle Causeway will be closed on the following dates: July 1st, 6th, 13th, 20th, and 27th, August 3rd, 10th, 17th, 24th, and 31st, and September 7th. All of these days, it will be closed from 6 a.m. to 10 p.m. Shifting now to the fall, some select locations when the LaSalle Causeway will also be closed from 6 a.m. to 8 p.m. September 21st, October 5th, 14th and 19th, and November 2nd and 16th. Here are your road closures for the week. Albert Street, Princess to Mac is closed to accommodate construction activity and staging at 484 Albert Street. Aberdeen Street, William 2 Johnson is closed to accommodate construction activity and staging. Berry Street, Queen to Colborne is closed for construction-related activity at 283 Queen Street. Barrack Street, Bagot to Rideau is closed June 30th, July 2nd, and 3rd from 8 a.m. to 3 p.m. each day to accommodate road repair and resurfacing work. Cassidy Street, Montreal to Maple is closed until July 4th as part of the ongoing intersection improvements of Montreal and John Counter. Carlton Street, Alfred to Guy is closed June 30th to August 8th for a gas main installation. Earl Street, Collingwood to Toronto is closed for sewer separation and road rehabilitation work. Guy Street, Carlton to Division is also closed June 30th to August 8th for gas main installation. King Street, Brock to Clarence is closed July 1st from 5 p.m. to 11 p.m. for the City of Kingston Canada Day event. Market Street, King to Ontario is closed June 30th at 8 a.m. to July 2nd at 12 p.m. for the City of Kingston Canada Day event. Ontario Street, Brock to Clarence is closed July 1st from 8 a.m. to 11:59 p.m. for the City of Kingston Canada Day event. South Bartlett Street, Smith to Victoria is closed until August 29th for construction-related activity at 655 Princess Street. Sydenham Street, Princess to Queen is closed until October 3rd for the Sydenham Street Community Space. Victoria Street, Union to Johnson is closed for sewer separation and road rehabilitation work. And Victoria Street, Princess to North Bartlett is also closed until August 29th for construction-related activity at 655 Princess Street. Here are some other delays to be aware of. Accommodation Road, 6th concession to White Church, expect delays while the contractor is completing work on the annual surface treatment contract. Abidon Road, middle to Highway 2, expect delays while the contractor is completing work on the annual surface treatment contract. Bay Ridge Drive, Milford to Henderson, expect delays for the construction of new active transportation infrastructure. Cataraqui Woods Drive, Centennial to Gardeners, expect delays for the construction of a new multi-use pathway. Collins Bay Road, Woodbine to Princess, expect delays while a contractor completes landscaping work on Collins Bay Road. Front Road, Sand Bay to Country Club, expect delays for the installation of sanitary and water main for Utilities Kingston. Traffic is down to one lane in each direction. Gardner's Road at Centennial and Creekford, expect delays while a contractor completes intersection widening, traffic signal upgrades, and cycling and pedestrian improvements. Garrett Road, 6th concession to Sand Hill, expect delays while a contractor is completing work on the annual surface treatment contract. Highway 2 to Abidon and St. Lawrence, expect delays to complete enhanced flood protection of Abidon Road, Highway 2, and St. Lawrence Avenue. Highway 15, Kingston Mills to Middle, expect delays for a contractor to complete work on the Highway 15 CNR overhead structure. Montreal Street at John Counter, expect delays for upgrades to the intersection, including new lighting, traffic signals, lanes, paving, and signage to improve safety and efficiency for all road users. Victoria Street and Earl Street, expect delays while a contractor mobilizes the site to start work on the second phase of reconstruction of sewer, water main, sidewalks, and road. And Whitechurch Road, 6th concession to Woodburn, expect delays while the contractor is completing work on the annual surface treatment contract.
Now coming up, we'll have a look at some great community events running in Kingston and the area this week. On Monday, Art Fest Kingston continues at City Park from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. You can explore over 165 artist booths. Check out the J. Bell Redbird Indigenous Arts Pavilion and enjoy poetry readings, kids' art tents, yoga, tarot card readings, face painting, and food trucks. It's free and family-friendly. On Tuesday, Art Fest wraps up with its final day in City Park, open again from 10 to 5 p.m. And of course, it's Canada Day, so there's lots going on. The Great Canadian Stroll and Roll Parade kicks off at 11:30 a.m. from the Metro lot at Berry Street. Families are encouraged to decorate bikes, strollers, scooters, and wagons for a fun parade down Princess Street towards Ontario Street. At 12:30 p.m., opening remarks and cake cutting happen in Confederation Park, along with activities like rock climbing, inflatables for the kids, and face painting. Then cap off your Canada Day with the fireworks display at 10 p.m., visible from Confederation Park or Springer Market Square. Bring a chair and arrive early to grab a good spot. On Wednesday, Games in the Square returns to Springer Market Square from 6 to 8 p.m. Drop in for a fun evening of giant board games like Connect Four, Chess, and Snakes and Ladders. It's free, open to all ages, and a great way to enjoy a midweek summer night downtown. On Thursday, Stories in the Square starts at 10:30 a.m. at the City Hall Amphitheater. This free drop-in story time is hosted by the Kingston Frontenac Public Library and is perfect for kids of all ages. If the weather's bad, it will move indoors to the Central Branch. In the evening, Life Drawing is on at Art Noise from 6 to 8 p.m. Doors open at 5:30, and it's just $10 to drop in and practice figure drawing in a welcoming space. Then head to Springer Market Square for Movies in the Square. This week's feature is Legally Blonde, with pre-movie fun including a glitter bar and nail stickers from 6:30 to 8:30 p.m. The movie starts at dusk, so bring your own lawn chair and enjoy a night under the stars. On Friday, folks can head back to Springer Market Square from 6 to 7 p.m. for free line and square dancing lessons. Whether you're new or experienced, it's a great way to kick off your Friday night in the square before the live country music begins. On Saturday, it's time for the Bloomin'Berry Strawberry Social at the Spire from 11 a.m. to 3 p.m. Enjoy strawberry shortcake, garden games, crafts, live music, and a strawberry hat parade, all in support of the Bloom Skills Center. Admission is $15 and includes dessert, drinks, and activities. And finally on Sunday, start your day off with yoga in the park at Battery Park from 10 to 11 a.m. This free outdoor session is led by local instructors and you just need to bring a mat. In the afternoon, Baha'i Fireside Sunday happens at 2 p.m. in the lower hall at the Spire. It's an open, informal discussion about unity and peace, hosted by the Baha'i community of Kingston. Refreshments are served and all are welcome. Have a local event that you would like covered on CFRC's website and our news programming? Contact us today via cfrc.ca. Hey folks, I'm Ellie Sturton, and coming up are your live music events happening around town this week. On Monday, celebrate the night before Canada Day with a few great options. The Cove Inn is hosting a pre-Canada Day party from 7 to 11 p.m. with high-energy East Coast tunes and a buffet dinner. For country fans, head to the Kingston Grand Theater at 7 p.m. for Mo Pitney with openers Honky Tonk Heart and Griffin McGill. And if you're looking to jam, Rosewell Rehearsals is hosting an afternoon hang from 1 to 3 p.m. It's just $10 to join and snacks are included. Or for a welcoming night of music, the Gender Diverse Song Circle invites trans, non-binary, and gender diverse folks to sing and connect beginning at 6 p.m. Location is to be announced. On Tuesday, it's Canada Day. And at the Cove Inn, Soulfire is live on the patio from 6 to 9 p.m. for a free all-ages show. At the Mansion, the A-List Festival runs from 1 to 9 p.m. with food, drinks, giveaways, and a full lineup of local bands with tickets starting at $15. Folks can head to Confederation Park, which hosts live sets from Kevin Head, Brass Over Tea Kettle, and Los Garcias. Or head to Springer Market Square, which turns into a giant dance floor from 6 to 10 p.m., headlined by Scratch Bastard. At West Swinks Island Park, there's a full day of Canada Day fun with live music from local bands, vendors, and comedians running from 9:30 a.m. to 10 p.m. On Wednesday, pop by the Mansion for surf rock and rockabilly with the Surfer Jets and Bloodshot Bill starting at 7 p.m. for just $25. Or catch Swingin' Summer in Springer Market Square with the Frontenac Community Band from 7 to 8 p.m. On Thursday, the Holly Road Country Jamboree kicks off in Corbyville at 7 p.m. See a stacked lineup of Canadian country talent. Tickets start at $44.25 and fundraise for Camp Trillium. You can hear pianist Agne Radzevichite and Dmitry Lekovich perform classical selections at St. Paul's Church at 3:15 p.m. Tickets are $45 for adults and $22.50 for youth. Or dance the night away at Musiki Cafe's vinyl DJ party from 8 to 11. Entry is by donation. On Friday, catch day two of the Holly Road Country Jamboree in Corbyville. You'll see Aaron Goodwin, Rudy Gunn, and more. Or head to Hotel Wolf Island for day one of the Analog Island Festival, a night of experimental music, live bands, and vinyl DJ sets. Day passes for that one are $30. The Mansion hosts Metal Night with Doom Boys, The Pale Horse Ritual, Arachnia, and more. Doors open at 8 p.m. and tickets are $11.98. Now, if country's more your thing, Ambush plays a free outdoor set at Springer Market Square from 7 to 8. And later that night, at The Merchant, Squid Pistol hits the stage with high-energy alternative rock covers from 10:30 p.m. to 1 a.m. On Saturday, start with Saturday Sessions, live music in Confederation Park from 11:30 to 3:30. This week features Django's Kitchen, Oscar Bossax, and Mauricio and the Latin Beat Band. Or, over at Base 31's Drill Hall, Montreal Dream Pop Legends start Stars hit the stage with Ruby Waters at 7:30 p.m. Tickets start at $55. And the Hollywood Country Jamboree continues in Corbyville with a stacked Day 3 lineup, including George Canyon, Mackenzie Leigh Meyer, Fiddlesticks, and more. And at Hotel Wolf Island, the Analog Island Festival continues with experimental sets, film screenings, and queer karaoke. Also on Saturday, the Mansion Summer Kickoff Fest goes from 3 to 10 p.m. on the patio with plenty of live bands, barbecue, lawn games, and sunshine. Tickets start at $22.63. And if you're looking for something nostalgic, catch a Beatles tribute show at the Spire from 7 to 9:45 p.m. Tickets are $42.50, and the event fundraises for food and housing programs through Lion's Heart, Inc. And finally on Sunday, start your day off with jazz brunch at the Black Dog Tavern from 11:30 to 2:30 p.m. Or at Time Out Bar and Bistro, folks can see Lady and the Lads perform classic country starting at 3 p.m. Over at Finkelshore Park, Live Music Sundays runs from 2 to 5 p.m. with David Shutter at 2, Barry Ewan and his trio at 3, and Willows and Oaks at 4. At Hotel Wolf Island, Day 3 of the Analog Island Festival runs from 12 to 5:30 p.m. and features jazz, ambient, and experimental performances with Tone Map and Wallace, Potions, and Sandro Perry. And finally, folks can see the Co-Conspirators perform live at the Opinicon from 1 to 4 p.m. with a relaxing set of acoustic folk and roots by the Canal. Have a local concert that you would like covered on CFRC's website and our news programming? Contact us today via cfrc.ca.
Thank you for tuning in to CFRC's local news programming. To revisit episodes of Today in YGK and hear more from some of our guests, be sure to head to our podcast network at podcast.cfrc.ca. Today in YGK is brought to you by the generous support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada under the Local Journalism Initiative, Queen's University Career Services, What Will I Wear, 732 Princess Street, and The Screening Room at screeningroomkingston.com. Be sure to stay tuned for more CFRC programming coming up next.
What'll I Wear offers the best in vintage, funky, one-of-a-kind treasures, clothing, accessories, and a fabulous selection of jewels, vintage and new. Find the cutest purse, the most dashing of hats and sunglasses, everything to complete your individual look. What'll I Wear has it all. They can dress you from top to bottom. Find your new fashion fave at What'll I Wear at 732 Princess Street in Kingston. Visit their new location and follow them on Facebook to keep up to date with what's in store at What'll I Wear.
Good day. You're listening to Free City Radio. I'm Stefan Christoph, and this is edition 272. On the broadcast this week, I'm going to be featuring a conversation with longtime community organizer and activist Helen Hudson. I've known Helen for a long time in Montreal. Helen's been involved in a number of intersecting struggles looking at local migrant justice struggles. So that is for equality for migrants and refugees against forced detention and deportation by the Canadian government. Helen has also long done work to support political prisoners, including members of the Black Panther Party. And in general, I really think Helen is an activist that is important to listen to. I've been doing a series of interviews to think about the connections between the years after 9/11 and the present, tying the protest movement against the U.S.-led invasion of Iraq to the current protest movement against the Israeli attacks and genocidal actions in Gaza, Palestine. This interview really looks at the intersections between local struggles and global struggles, thinking about how community mobilizations at a very local level can speak to and embody these intersecting global issues, how war manifests at home, how racism manifests in communities, and how that is reflected in state policy, and most importantly, the ways that people are organizing to oppose those points of injustice. So it's really a pleasure to speak with Helen Hudson for Free City Radio, and I will now just jump to our conversation. Right now, there's all this political discussion around an acceptance that somehow borders should be militarized. This has been embraced in this, you know, territory that is called Canada by you know, political factions, of course, from the conservatives, but also the Liberal Party. And a lot of that militarization obviously doesn't happen out of nowhere. There's a push from this sort of neo-fascist administration in the United States under Trump. And then that builds on, like, all this, like, years and years of, like, a very racialized push to militarize the U.S.-Mexico borderline. So, Helen, I was thinking of your community involvement in the years after 9/11 and how a lot of organizers at the time were trying to make a connection between opposing the militarization of the border lines, colonial border lines, and thinking about how that was tied to opposing quote-unquote war, so U.S. invasion of Iraq or the multi-country invasion of Afghanistan that Canada joined. Maybe you could just briefly introduce yourself and, like, you know, share whatever you'd like to about your work now, working in relation to nursing and public healthcare systems that support a lot of people, clearly, but also your involvement at that time as somebody who was playing a very important support role for a lot of activists. Thank you.
Okay, so yes, hi. So my name is Helen Hudson. I am a queer black woman living in Kanyakahaga, Montreal. At the time period that we're talking about, I was one of the staff people, one of the coordinators at CUPER Concordia, so an activist group at Concordia campus where a lot of stuff was happening that I'm sure we'll be talking about. As a staff person, like you said, my role was often to support other people's work rather than being on the front lines myself, although I was on the front lines in a number of other capacities as well. Starting around that time, my own organizing kind of shifted into focus primarily on prisoner justice work. In 2004, I went to nursing school and, you know, came to work as a nurse, which I did for a number of years, shifted again at some point, and I'm now kind of circling around the edges of academia, studying access to end-of-life care in prison. Thinking a lot about health systems, but that also in relation to social justice work. Less involved in day-to-day on-the-ground activism for a number of reasons at this point. So, yeah, watching everything unfolding that we're going to be talking about today.
Thanks for the introduction. It's very meaningful. Could you identify, like, maybe a few reflections or thoughts you might have about why this time period of sort of the post, quote-unquote, 9/11 environment and how migrants were criminalized during this time is important to consider now? I mean, I remember in activist spaces at the time we were talking about the, quote-unquote, war at home and war abroad. Yeah, maybe you could unpack that and sort of share a little bit from your vantage point what people were talking about or experiencing.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think one of the key things about the so-called post 9/11 period is that a lot of things were experiencing a shift. People's mindset, the political terrain in terms of the overall, you know, broad mainstream, but then also what people were organizing around, their analysis. It experienced this shift at the moment that we heard the news that the planes had hit the Twin Towers. So if I'm going to talk about that shift, it's important to talk about what was happening right before, right? So in terms of militant organizing, there was the anti-globalization movement where that was a lot of people's point of entry into radical organizing, whether they, you know, went on to focus on other issues. A lot of people were drawn to this so-called anti-globalization movement that was opposing neoliberalism, which is, you know, what capitalism was calling itself, what capitalism was doing at the time. We'll probably talk a bit more about how that shifted over time. And the form that that took was opposing sort of visible comings together of capitalist supporting state apparatuses. So, you know, meetings of like the World Bank, the IMF, the Summit of the Americas, which was about the North American Free Trade Agreement. And so people would kind of rally around these meetings. But there was a saying at the time that action is in the organizing, right? Mm-hmm. So while people were doing that, people were deepening their thinking about the interconnectedness of a whole bunch of issues, right? Mm-hmm. So what is the border? Does the border regulate the movement of people or the movement of capital, the movement mm-hmm. of goods? How does it do that differently for all those things? How do the states interact with each other? How do the states mm-hmm. interact with transnational capital? All these kinds of things were being discussed. Mm-hmm. It was a quite white-dominated movement for the most part, but people of color involved in it were really taking the opportunity to make interventions into that, right? So at all of these summits in the global north, mm-hmm. when there'd be gatherings of activists to oppose these various summits, there would be sort of a critical mass of people of color being like, wait a second, what about racism in the movement? Wait a second, what about, you know, poor communities of color that are being displaced for these summits, etc., right? So an analysis was being deepened. Particular context in Montreal, in Quebec, was the militant student movement. At the time, we were kind of coming off a wave of student strikes at the Cégep level. And so I only moved to Montreal in 1999, so kind of close in time right before this. But what I was seeing at Concordia was, you know, organizing that was influenced by organizing in Montreal that had happened before, right? It wasn't kind of, you know, coming out of nowhere. And so then in the several months before 9/11, almost a year before 9/11, mm-hmm. the Second Intifada broke out in Palestine. Mm-hmm. And Palestinian students, other Arab and Muslim students were beginning to mobilize at Concordia, and Concordia became a real focus point for Palestine solidarity in Montreal. You know, a lot of demonstrations would start from Concordia and then sort of wind their way through downtown from there. And discussions within that organizing deepened the analysis of, I would say, activists across all sectors. So, you know, the anti-globalization movement, student movement, folks that was, you know, still a fairly white-dominated space, mm-hmm. coming to interact with Arab and Muslim students, Palestinian students, organizing around the Intifada. So when 9/11 happened, mm-hmm. I was surprised, as a person who spent part of my childhood living in a military dictatorship and part of my childhood living in Western Europe, where, you know, the folks my grandparents' age, including my grandparents, still remembered Nazi occupation. I was surprised at how surprised a lot of folks were by 9/11. But that is not to say that I was not surprised. So many things changed. Like I said, it was already starting to organize around prisoner justice, organizing with political prisoners in the States. Most, if not all, political prisoners were placed incommunicado as soon as 9/11 happened. There's actually a poem by the late Marilyn Buck, a political prisoner from the Weather Underground, called Incommunicado, about how it just the clampdown was immediate. The explosion of Islamophobia was immediate. So what I was seeing as the staff person at Cooper Concordia was folks that really, you know, didn't see Cooper as their home base on campus, coming in asking if they could just sit there and study because they were getting harassed in the library, coming and asking if they could come in and pray because there was nowhere else that they felt safe praying on campus. So, and then all of us who had been involved in the anti-globalization movement coming to have to shift our thinking about what does this organizing now mean? Like, it was kind of clear that, you know, militantly opposing global summits and, you know, like throwing stuff at the riot cops and like this kind of thing was going to meet with a different reaction in the post 9/11 period. But then also questions are being asked about, is this the most useful thing to be doing right now, right? Like, when there is this crackdown on folks in the Arab world, folks in the global south, you know, how should we be responding to that here?
Well, that's really great context. If you don't mind, to just maybe just describe a bit how there was a choice and sort of also a lot of discussions, many, many meetings around doing work around migration and borders and how that was sort of built, sort of connected to the context that you were just describing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so immediately after September 11th, I'm thinking of one big meeting in particular that I believe was on September 13th, if I'm not mistaken. Folks were like, you know, the clampdown's already started, but it's gonna get worse, right? Like, it was clear from the beginning that there was gonna be war. And so a lot of people's focus just shifted to there, like, we're gonna have to become an anti-war movement. But at the same time, like I was saying, Islamophobia, racism was exploding here as well, right? So the experience of being brown in Montreal changed in that moment as well. And so I think for folks that were already connected to migrant communities in particular, it was clear that something had to happen. And so my own memory of it was sort of a percolation over several months of, you know, people having sort of smaller individual conversations on the sidelines, in some cases within the context of that anti-war organizing, right? Like, there'd be like an organizing meeting for an anti-war demo, and then some folks would like not be totally happy with how the meeting went down, and there'd be, you know, kind of a debrief on the sidelines, and like discussions of migrant justice would come up there. And it just sort of started to coalesce after a couple of months, probably more than a couple, but after a few months. And at the moment, I'm trying to remember like exact months and years to think about, you know, the formation that today is Solidarity Across Borders kind of went through several iterations, several kind of versions of people trying to come together. While that was happening, various migrant communities themselves were internally organizing. And one that I'm thinking of is the Action Committee of Non-Status Algerians, in French acronym, the CAS, came together when Canada lifted its moratorium on deportations to Algeria, which is completely connected to that post 9/11 shift, right? And to global capital, right? Like, Canada had like trade relationships that were developing with Algeria that had shifted such that it was no longer politically tenable for the Canadian state to be seen as naming Algeria as an unsafe country. Basically lifted the deportation moratorium. There's about 1,000 non-status Algerians in Canada at the time, the vast majority of them in Montreal. So those folks were very visibly self-organizing and visibly from Concordia. I remember seeing this demo. You know, myself and others were in the Kuberg offices, which overlooked de Maisonneuve and Guy. We saw this large demonstration coming past, and it's unusual to, you know, have there be a large demonstration and us not be in it or, you know what was going on. And it turned out to be the Action Committee of Non-Status Algerians that were starting to organize. And so folks went out and sort of made some connections and stuff. And it, I think one of the things that kind of coalesced the sort of broader, like, multi-community migrant justice organizing that became eventually Solidarity Across Borders started with folks who were not part of the Algerian community kind of looking to see in what ways they could support that movement, that group. And then, you know, similarly, there was organizing of Palestinian refugees, Pakistani refugees, you know, a number of other groups.
You know, one thing that comes to my mind also, like, just as a side note, you talked about the Canadian government's relationship to the Algerian government. Mm-hmm. And something that I think that's probably not talked about enough is how there was a deepening of relationships between state apparatuses within government structures in post-colonial contexts that were willing to sort of play the game, so to speak, in terms of the quote-unquote war on terror. So that took place in the context of Syria, in the context of Algeria, in context of Sudan, even. And so just to note, just for people who are listening, to sort of look into that, because it was a very important sort of confluence of, like, political and security apparatus forces that was at play after 9/11. And that, of course, relates to what you're talking about in the context of the decision of the Canadian government to remove the moratorium on deportations to Algeria. So I'll just ask you straight out, like, why do you think this sort of confluence of discussions and also the different, like, organizational frameworks that we're sort of gathering in the context of post 9/11 and then in the context of thinking about how we oppose war? I mean, it was pretty clear that people, a lot of people, particularly in Montreal as a city, were opposed to the US-led war, but there was a lot of ways of how that was articulated. and a lot of questions and a lot of debates. And I think about this last year in Montreal, we're in 2025, so 2024, 2023, these massive demonstrations in solidarity with Palestine. I just would love to hear your reflections about like why connecting the local and the global is important when we think about these protests, because often even until now, these protests are very much covered like, oh, they're about something that's happening far away.
Yeah. No, and for sure, it's intimately connected. And I think, you know, that example of like the entanglement of like the Canadian state and the Algerian state that, you know, became visible with the CAS organizing is very important, because when we think about what will succeed in intervening in a war, right? Like, how do we stop war? Having demonstrations is a really important part of that, but it's not gonna stop the war on its own, right? And that was the debate that happened at the time. You know, war is one part of a larger global system, of which, like, transnational capital and, like, the displacement of people that then end up here are other parts, right? Like, they're all interrelated. And so one thing I want to say about the connection between that time period we're talking about and now is when 9/11 happened, there was a deep-rooted Islamophobia, deep-rooted racism that was already in existence, like the framework of which already existed, that became visible, became emboldened, became, you know, mainstreamed, right? And now that same Islamophobia, that same racism is never gone back to a pre-9/11 level, right? So now that's just kind of like ambient, right? Like, you know, when October 7th, 2023, that level of Islamophobia that would have seemed shocking before 9/11, that was already the baseline, right? So that's part of the organizing conditions that we're facing today. And that's something that I think makes it useful to look back to, you know, how do we adjust to a just kind of ramping up of, you know, what is considered acceptable in terms of, you know, hatred, in terms of backlash, in terms of police repression, these kinds of things. So that's one thing I wanted to say, but that doesn't really answer your question. So now I need to backtrack to some of the other directions my mind was going in. Oh, yes. So opposing war at home. Like, how does opposing war relate to migrant justice organizing? So in a very real and immediate sense, folks are displaced by war, right? Like, people are being displaced from Syria, from Palestine, from Sudan, as we speak. But that those displacements are like particular peaks in a sort of ongoing like onslaught of displacement, right? So one of the things that was really eye-opening for a lot of folks, including myself, and really like helped deepen our analysis in organizing with CAS, alongside CAS, in support of CAS, you know, and other communities in with which eventually became Solidarity Across Borders, but I'm thinking of CAS in particular, understanding the relationship between war and displacement, and then understanding the relationship of that to migrant organizing here, but realizing as an activist who's not directly affected that the solidarity then is in two directions, in the sense that it's not just like those who are not directly affected helping other people, right? It's not like charity. There's so much to be learned from organizers that have, you know, migrated to Canada, that are living the sort of economic underbelly, right? Like the folks that are really, you know, driving, like, you know, the gig economy and the Amazon warehouses and like all that invisible labor that keeps Canada, migrant farm workers as well, keeps Canada running, right? And so now the direction my brain was going in, right, is just realizing then in relationship with folks that are directly affected by the border, like it kind of gives a lie to, you know, states in general, but Canada in particular, wanting to like ebb the flow of migrants, right? So all this like border security rhetoric of like, you know, migrants are taking our housing, they're taking our jobs, they're the cause of homelessness, all of this kind of stuff that like the state knows full well that Canada would grind to a halt, the Canadian economy would grind to a halt without all of these precarious workers, right? So, and that only becomes visible to folks that are not directly affected if we are in those spaces, deepening our analysis in conversation, in relationship with folks that are directly affected.
There's so many strands that could be picked up from this. And I really thank you for talking about this. One thing in particular that kind of stands out is also how Quebec represented itself in relation to the protests in opposition to the U.S.-led invasion of Iraq. Because I remember media coverage, particularly in French at the time. I've been looking at this recently. You'll have like an image of young, you know, racialized kids, basically, you know, with keffiyehs chanting or holding a Palestinian flag. But then the text of the article is all about sort of Quebec, you know, sort of being an anti-war society. It's very much focused on the sort of Quebecois voice as opposed to sort of the confluence of forces in Montreal that made up those demonstrations, right? And I remember at the time also like a lot of debates within the sort of larger coalitions of groups trying to organize against war, trying to name that and to create space for all the different groups that are possible. And it's interesting just in the sense of, you know, thinking about how moments are represented and remembered, because that whole thing is often talked about as like Quebec protested the U.S. invasion of Iraq. But if you're in the protests, you're going to see Syrian kids and South Asian kids and all sorts of people, you know, joining those protests, of course, Palestinian kids. But I think that that brings up sort of a question about historical representation and how it plays out in the present, and also why like rethinking sort of how things are remembered is important. And I'm sure you have lots to say on that.
Yeah, no, absolutely. You know, like history depends on who's writing it, right? And so, you know, and this is why I really appreciate you doing this series of interviews, not just with me, but with like, you know, a whole bunch of folks that were involved at the time. Because, yeah, you know, I do think the protests in Montreal, in Quebec, had maybe a different feeling, a different vibe, character, whatever you want to call it, to some other places in North America because of things that are specific to Quebec, you know, trade union movement, anti-war movement from other times, Quebec separatist movement, creates a set of infrastructure, a set of, you know, traditions, militant culture that are particular to this space. However, you know, as you said, if you look who's in these demonstrations, then also if you look at who gets included within that category of who is Quebec and when, right? And the sort of convenience-based shifting of the you know, container, like the edges of the container, because it was also not too long after that that there was the reasonable accommodations hearings, right, where there was like you know, political movement and a, you know, political rhetoric in Quebec of like brown people not being part of Quebec, right, and like people coming in and taking over with Islam, and like was it okay for like people to be wearing hijab in public, that has now, you know, given rise to like Bill 21, and you know, all of that has evolved as well.
Bill 21
being a Quebec piece of legislation, people still call it Bill 21, it's passed into law now, banning people in the public service from publicly displaying religious symbols, which theoretically would include, you know, a crucifix, a kippah, a turban, but like numerically in terms of who's impacted by this, it's largely hijabi women. So because people in positions like teachers, for example, you could not be a teacher and wear hijab under this law. So Yeah, so it's kind of interesting because it's been a long time since I've thought about the media coverage of, you know, post 9/11 and your organizing in Quebec. So it's interesting to have you remind me that of that rhetoric. That yeah, this, you know, look at how militant Quebec is being in opposing war, but it's the parts of Quebec that are only included in Quebec when it's convenient. And I mean, not to let the Canadian state off the hook either, right? It has a particular flavor here in Quebec, but like, I think that you could find similar dynamics that play throughout the Canadian state and beyond.
Lots to reflect on. We'll leave it there. Thank you, Helen, for the conversation today.
You're more than welcome.
That was a conversation with longtime community organizer Helen Hudson on Free City Radio. I'm Stefan Christoph. Thank you so much for tuning in. We broadcast weekly on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal on Wednesdays at 11 a.m. on CJLO 1690 a.m. also in Montreal on Wednesdays at 8 a.m. on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on Tuesdays at 8 a.m. on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario on Wednesdays at 11:30 a.m. on CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria on Saturdays at 7 a.m. on Met Radio 1280 a.m. in Toronto on Fridays at 5:30 a.m. on CKCU 93.1 FM in Ottawa on Tuesdays at 2 p.m. and on CGSF 90.1 FM in Vancouver on Thursdays at 4:30 p.m. You can find our archives at soundcloud.com/freecityradio. And we are also a podcast. Look us up. Just search Free City Radio. I'm Stefan Christoph. Thanks for tuning in, and we will speak to you next week.